This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer podcast, as we have a special health episode today. We were in conversation with John, who's lost more than 30 kilos, an amazing feat in itself, but he only found out he had diabetes and was able to make these lifestyle changes once he had a COVID diagnosis. Hearing his story and hearing from his doctor too about diabetes during the pandemic. And in conversation with Dr. Biden straight from the States, 5 a.m. where he was, bless him, talking about neck and back pain. He was taking your questions too and giving some great advice on overall spine health, even before you get into pain and going down to your feet. It was a special foot clinic with Chief Podiatrist Michelle Champlin from the Dubai Podiatry Clinic, as we were talking about some of the common issues that she's seeing in clinic and taking your questions as well. Everything from pain when you put your foot down, pain when you're running, and all sorts of weird and wonderful symptoms. And in our psychology hour, Dr. Chastity O'Connell was on hand as we discussed the billionaire breakup, Bill and Melinda Gates filing for divorce. He is worth $124 billion, which just goes to show money can't buy love. But we are seeing a huge rise in what is known as a grey divorce. People separating after decades together in their 50s, 60s, and even 70s. What are some of the reasons behind it? And Dr. Chastity was taking your questions too.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking health this afternoon, and John Duval didn't know he had diabetes until he got COVID, and as he recovered from the virus, he also had to deal with this diagnosis, making big lifestyle changes in order to lose weight, and he's now down more than 30 kilos. He's joining us live from Golden Eagle Martial Arts, where he is an instructor. John, thank you so much. How is your health today, sir?
You're very welcome. It was nice to be on the show for you guys. I'm very pleased. I am feeling absolutely fantastic. Like you said, it was a complete shock when I found out about this, when I got COVID and was in hospital. But before I begin, I would like to just give a big thanks to the UAE for all their efforts and for keeping us safe, and their efforts of controlling this pandemic, and to the DHA and everybody at Thumbe Hospital. This is where I was admitted, for their care. And, you know, when I was there the entire time for a week, they never made me feel as if I was alienated. You know, I was never alienated. I was treated, you know, with real care. And, you know, when they were coming in to check me and this and that, I did not feel as if they were like, keeping distance or I mean, they had full protection and gear, of course, but still they were coming in and they were very humble and very nice and very, attentive. And I really, really thank them and appreciate everything.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear, John. And absolutely. Shout out to the UA, shout out to the frontline workers, because it can be those little glances and kind words that can, you know, really change an experience.
Absolutely. And it's not easy.
No, my goodness, no. So is it fair to say that, kind of this diagnosis almost changed your life? When were you diagnosed with COVID, first of all?
Well, this was in November last year. So it came to a Thursday evening, and then suddenly I got a little bit of a throat pain, and then which I didn't think much of it, because, you know, all my life I had tonsillitis to come and go. So I said, okay, so it's tonsillitis again. And then I got a fever that night, and I didn't like it. And then I said, it's normal anyway with tonsillitis. But then, you know, Friday morning, I still had the fever, and it wouldn't even go down, and it wouldn't break, provided I've taken all, you know, Panadol and all the medications. So I said, okay, time to go to just have a quick check. So I went to the clinic, and I had my blood test taken, and they took the COVID test. And then immediately I went back to the house to isolate until the results came out. Then on Saturday, they told me that I was positive, and I was like, impossible. I said, come on, guys, are you serious? And they said, yes, I said, how? I mean, we are so careful mm-hmm. in everything we do, you know, with gloves and with masks and social distancing and, you know, not socializing. And I mean, we were like literally quarantining ourselves the entire time, even when we were at work. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it was a complete shock. But anyway, you don't know where you could have got
That's
it from.
Right.
It could have been from anywhere, you know? So I said, oh my goodness. And then I spoke to the doctor, and the doctor told me from the clinic, and she said that we recommend that you go to the hospital. And I said, okay, but I'm feeling okay. You see, the thing is, she didn't tell me completely what's going on. She just said, just call the DHA. Maybe you should go to the hospital and see what's happening, and just to, you know, just to be under care. So she kept being positive the whole time. So I was like, okay, I didn't think much of it. So I said, great. Okay. So I called the DHA, and then I went directly to the Hawanese test center, and then they retested again, and they took chest x-rays before, you know, quite a few years back, I had pneumonia. Mm-hmm. So this is why I was, you know, constantly doing breathing exercises. And of course, from Tai Chi and Qigong, it helped to maintain the good lung capacity, the strength of the lungs. So when I had the x-ray in the DHA location, the doctor was very nice, came very calmly and said, well, we would like to just admit you to the hospital just for, you know, observation for a day or two. I said, what's wrong? I said, come on.
That's where your brain goes.
I said, what's going on? She goes, John, there's nothing to be worried about, but just the COVID virus has entered into your lungs more than 10%. So just a little bit more than 10%. Now, they didn't mention anything else. They just said it just went into your lungs a little bit more than 10%. And we just want to, you know, keep you under observation. And I said, let's go. So immediately they took me to Thumbe Hospital. This is where I was admitted. And then immediately when I went in, I had tests again. And I tell you, my arm was dying.
Oh, like a pin cushion.
From all the tests and the needles, you know. And then they came. The doctor came and said, okay, so your sugar level. Well, first he said, do you have diabetes? I said, no. Have you ever had diabetes? I said, no. And he said, anybody in your family has diabetes? I said, not that I'm aware of. So then he said, okay, so your sugar level is over 400.
Mm-hmm.
I said, is that bad? Is that good? Because, you know, not having diabetes, I'm not familiar with diagnosis and the sugar level and so on. He said, yes, that's not very good. And your blood pressure is 176. So basically, I was on the verge of having you know, an attack, whether it's a heart attack or go into a coma or whatever, a seizure or whatever.
John, my goodness!
So I know, right? So immediately, I was like, I sat down and I was just like, I feel fine, doc.
And he's like, well, that's a worry in itself because the numbers are not fine. And, you know, you're a healthy guy. You're a martial arts instructor.
Yes, absolutely. Yes,
so you've obviously since had the all clear for COVID, but you've made some really big lifestyle changes. As I said, you're down more than 30 kilos. What have you changed and how is your diabetes now?
Well, once I was in the hospital, I was like I said, I was in the hospital for a week, and then they had me on insulin injections three times a day and blood thinners. So once I was there and I knew what was happening, the hardest time was mentally. It is a mental exhaustion because you have to maintain complete positive attitude so it doesn't get worse. So you don't go on a ventilator, mm-hmm. you see? So this was really, really mentally challenging, and we had to be positive and, of course, lots of breathing and so on. And then I had lots of time, so I was researching about diabetes and so on, and I came across one video of a scientist, and she said, yes, this can be reversed, and with the right team, with the right care, it can be reversed, and just cut all the carbs. No rice, no pasta, no bread, and follow the simple instructions and so on. And I said, well, great. So from the time I was in hospital to by the time I got out, You know, I love to eat, you know, and during the lockdown.
Carbs are
during
friends.
During the lockdown, we all put a little bit away.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, the COVID-19.
From the time they put me in the hospital, it was like, you know, I couldn't munch on anything because it was like times when they brought in the food and it was all diabetic food. So it was healthy, you know, and there was nothing munching in between, you know, crisps or chips or whatever. So I already like lost like 6-7 kilos by the time I got out of the hospital.
And then you've just kept that momentum going.
Yes, you know, exactly.
you're an active guy. It sounds like you're well on the way to recovery. We're actually going to be speaking to your doctor next, Dr. Yusuf from Glucare, to tell us more about the story and how, you know, other diabetics can be adjusting their lifestyle to hopefully reverse it and stay healthy for as long as possible. John, thank you so much. It's really great to hear that you are not only on the mend, but doing brilliantly. Incredible that a COVID diagnosis has led to you living your healthiest life. So keep it up, won't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, for sure. And you know, if I can put it in remission in 3 months, so anybody can. You see, it just requires the right team, the right guidance. And I really thank Glucare Integrated Diabetes Center in Jumeirah, because they had a full integrated system, you know, when I called them, and I felt super comfortable, and they used one word over the phone which made me super comfortable. They said, "We are here with you on this journey."
Mm-hmm. Well, we're hearing more about that journey next. Thank you so much, John.
Yeah. Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
If you've just tuned in, we've been chatting with John, a martial arts instructor who got COVID late last year and discovered through blood tests at the hospital that he had diabetes. He's been working incredibly hard to lose around 30 kilos, changing his diet, changing his attitude, and in remission. He sought help and found Dr. Yusuf at Glucare, who helped him reverse his type 2 diabetes. Dr. Yusuf joining us now. Can you paint us a picture of John's condition when he approached you? He found out that he was really, really very unwell.
Hi, Helen. Thank you very much to be back on the show.
Pleasure.
Yeah, so we see John, and we are seeing a lot of patients like John who had really uncontrolled diabetes with high blood sugar levels, and HbA1c was detected when he was diagnosed of 12, which means that his average blood glucose was in the last 3 months over 200. So this was how John was coming to us. And we have to understand also the background of diabetes patients and about their self-management. Diabetes is a 24/7 hours condition that requires really immense of self-management. And we have to also to see that diabetes presents really differently in each patient, and it needs therefore really individualized care plan for these kind of patients. John mentioned already that it's important to have a supportive system with you to give you the background and the feedback how you can manage this, especially for those who was uncontrolled, like John, for example. And therefore, it's really helpful to have a system which can support you, especially because diabetes is a management disease. As you mentioned already, I have helped John. It's not really me. It's really always, I'm saying, the patients. It's the management system.
And
yeah, it's a team, really. And he is highly appreciated. You know, the patients know each care team members, yes, and they're really familiar with each other, the educator, nutritionist, the coach, so everybody knows about the patient and the patient knows these patient people, and this is a big support for this kind of patients.
Dr. Yusuf, John was living with diabetes completely undetected. Is that quite common to have diabetes and not know it?
Definitely, yes. As I mentioned, so John had an HbA1c of 12, which means he had the last 3 months before he was detected and go to the hospital, a blood glucose level over 200. So he didn't know that, yes. And this is very common also for other patients. There are sometimes typical symptoms that you are drinking much water, or you have to go frequently at the night to the toilet. For some patients, they will lose weight. So these signs of fatigue can be signs for to know maybe this can be diabetes. But yes, mostly one of four of diabetes patients are not detected.
Wow, wow. 25% of people that have diabetes don't even know about it. And John has reversed it in remission now, thanks to you. Can you tell us a little bit about the treatment plan that he was given? Maybe some advice for anyone out there who's suffering from diabetes that they could make some tweaks and changes.
Yeah, look, the most important thing in this kind of, especially type 2 diabetes, which is the lifestyle disease, is of course to change your lifestyle. It includes always diet, exercise, and a behavioral change. Yes, this is what we are working. So we are starting with our patients first to analyze them. Yes, so by giving them wearables, connecting them with technology and with the supportive care team and education, we will find out the patterns and the problems of these patients, what they have in their lifestyle. And then we will start to give them recommendations. Of course, some patients will need medications, some patients will need more education, and it's about then to really understand where is the points where we can track and help to do this lifestyle change. For an example, really simple, is our diets. You know, we know so much diets like keto diet, low-carb diet, Mediterranean diet, intermittent fasting. All of them can be successful. But it's important first to know which treats the best for the patient. And this you can only reach if you understand your patient, and especially now in these times by using technology.
Message here saying, is there anything you can do for someone who is pre-diabetic? Is that something you guys address at GluCare?
Yes. Before to getting diabetes, the most important thing is prevention, what we are trying to speak a lot about the media and to educate people about this, because pre-diabetes means this is a condition which you can go back into a normal status and this is then the end. For diabetes, it's different. When you're one-time diagnosed with diabetes, you only have a risk and you only have to go regularly to your health care provider. And pre-diabetes, it's important, again, to track the lifestyle, to see what the lifestyle is, and then to make exercise and diet and behavioral change in these kind of patients.
Dr. Yusuf, I know you are privy to a lot of studies, a lot of information, you know, peer work, patients coming in. For anyone out there, and we know how prevalent diabetes is in this region, unfortunately, but for anyone who is not diagnosed or maybe pre-diabetic, based on all of the information you have access to, is there anything that you do or don't do every single day to avoid getting diabetes that perhaps we need to listen to?
For myself, you mean?
Yes. What do you do to stay healthy?
Look, I'm really honest. Yes, I know, for example, that I have a lack of exercise because also of the work conditions what I have. So what I'm doing a lot is taking care of my nutrition. Yes, so I'm really taking care to avoid a lot of carbs. I'm taking care to not have many meals during the day. I'm trying to avoid late meals. So again, through a lot of things, sleep condition, sleeping patterns are really important. We are learning about our through the technology that if you have a lack of sleep, lack of REM sleep, deep sleep, this can affect your metabolism. Yes, and so there it's a holistic system, and I'm seeing where I have my problems and trying then really to avoid, especially through nutrition, to get something like diabetes, but I'm working on this, of course, to increase also my exercise.
Thank you, Dr. Yusuf. Really, really appreciate your time this afternoon. You can find Dr. Yusuf at GluCare. Sleep as a diagnosis for, I'll take that medication all night long.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing neck and back pain this afternoon with Mohammed Biden, MD, Professor of Neurosurgery, Orthopaedic Surgery and Health Services at Mayo Clinic, College of Hospital. You can tell I've just had some ice and my lips are a bit numb. College of Medicine and Science. And he has written a book called Back and Neck Health. It's the Mayo Clinic's guide to treating and preventing back and neck pain. It's something an overwhelming number of us will have suffered from at some point in our lives. And it's often that non-specific lower back pain diagnosis that can be so, so frustrating. So how can we prevent pain in the first place? What are some of the things that Dr. Byrne recommends? And ultimately, we're taking your questions too. So if you are in pain right now, maybe you're driving, pull over and message us. Maybe you're at home, you've got your laptop on your knee and you're sitting on the sofa and you're wondering what's going on, then this is your chance to get some advice. Doctor, how are you this afternoon?
Good. Thank you for having me, Helen.
I would just like to say we're on Microsoft Teams and your background looks like it looks exactly what I'd expect a kind of doctor's office to look like. I can see books in the background, a leather seat, very professional, unless you're at home on your sofa and it's a fake backdrop.
Well, it's not a backdrop. I am at home in my home office. And my hope is that my little one does not interrupt us anytime soon.
I did a video this morning for Farmer's Kitchen, which I'll show on a Thursday afternoon, and my dog was barking in the background. It's 2021. We know that these things happen, which brings me to my question. You're working from home. An awful lot of other people are working from home. What kind of impact is it having on our bodies, our back and neck specifically?
Well, and I should just clarify, I'm at home this morning for the interview because it's you know, 5 a.m. here in the States. Typically I go into work because as a surgeon, you know, I don't have the luxury to be able to work from home.
that would be a very impressive work from home setup.
It would. Well, and that day may not be that far away because already we're doing robotic surgery and already we're able to, you know, do things of that nature. And so that day may not be that far away. I would say, though, your question is a very good one. So many people's jobs have moved towards the Zoom environment or the Teams environment where they're doing a lot of work from home. And that can be problematic because it's even more sitting in the chair. It's even you're walking even less. I mean, it used to be that, you know, from the parking garage or, you know, from the bus drop to where your work may be, that was going to be your walk for the day. And now if you're just waking up, you know, from your bed to the couch, then, you know, people are having even more sedentary lifestyles. So I think that makes a lot of the issues that we're discussing today even more relevant.
You know, it's bad news when your daily step count is, you know, in the hundreds rather than the thousands because you have been going from sofa to kitchen to toilet back to sofa. So what are some of the things if people are working from home, well, they're starting to feel niggles, the beginning of what could be back or neck pain. What do you recommend we do every day to keep some good spine health?
Yeah. So I think, you know, daily, obviously, good nutrition is key in terms of your broad health. But also in addition, you know, exactly as you're saying, a moderate level of activity is very important so that people are not sedentary, you know, sitting around all day. So a moderate level of activity. And then, you know, some people in the morning, they like to wake up and do stretches. Some people like to wake up and do exercise. Some people prefer to do that towards the end of their day. Either way is fine, but back stretches, back exercises, those are always, you know, important things to strengthen the back. And anything that strengthens the core is something that's beneficial for the back because that's less, you know, our back is made up of bones and joints. And anything that strengthens the core reduces the pressure on the bones and joints to do the work that the back has to do.
We've got Dr. Byrne with us speaking from the States. He is the author of a new book about back and neck health from the Mayo Clinic. He's taking your questions as well. And I love this question from Hanan saying, I can't get comfortable at night. My neck feels stiff, especially at the base of my skull. Would love a pillow recommendation. Now, this is a controversial one. Are you a one pillow or a two pillow man? And what do you recommend?
So, right. You're right. This is very controversial. generally, the best thing for your back is a firm mattress, so not a soft mattress. Anyone who, you know, remembers the 1980s may remember water beds. Those are terrible for your back. And so the firmer the mattress, the better. And then, you know, I would add generally with a pillow, a thin pillow. And so one pillow is better than two. And a thin pillow is best. Sleeping on your back generally is best for your back. Sleeping on your side is second best. Sleeping on your stomach is just harder on your neck because you're extending your back and you're tilting your neck. And so that's probably the hardest position, especially if you do that consistently all night.
There you go, Hanan. And in terms of kind of density or material of a pillow, we're saying one thin one, could it be firm, feathers, where do you stand?
Yes, a firm is perfectly fine. Feathered is fine. As long as what you don't want is your sleeping position to be overly flexed or overly extended. As long as it's a nice neutral position for your neck, that would be the ideal.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are discussing neck and back pain, and unsurprisingly, many of you getting in touch because it is such a common area of concern. We're speaking to Mohammed Biden, MD, Professor of Neurosurgery, Orthopaedic Surgery and Health Services Research at the Mayo Clinic. He is in the States. It's 5 a.m. I trust you've had a coffee, and I hope you have, because we've got quite a lot of questions. How do you feel about a quick fire round?
Perfectly fine with a quick fire round. I don't drink coffee. I've made it this far, so I won't start.
Oh, you're my spirit animal. I don't either. And people keep on pressuring me. I'm like, do you know what? I don't like the taste, and I'm 38 years old, and I'm absolutely fine without it. Maybe a Diet Coke a day. Right. We are going to go into Gary. Gary says, woke up the other morning, could barely move due to neck pain that come on really suddenly. Still sore a couple of days later. I've got a slight sore throat, feel a bit bunged up. Is the neck pain related to a virus? Any suggestions to relief? Gel does nothing and paracetamol is just dimming the pain.
So great question from Gary. I think this is a common issue that many people experience. People should know low back pain is the number one reason to see your doctor. Neck pain is the number three reason to see your doctor. So low back pain and neck pain are two of the top five reasons to see your family doctor. Almost every single one of us in our lifetimes, 80%, will experience significant low back or neck pain in our lifetimes such that it will necessitate medical attention. Now, most of the time, those things are treated far short of surgery. So in Gary's case, it sounds like and obviously, you know, I want to be sure not to provide diagnoses on the air because I haven't seen or evaluated Gary. But what it sounds like is a muscular condition, a myalgia, pain of the muscles. That can occur with a respiratory illness. That can occur with COVID. That can occur with a common cold, a flu. So that can commonly occur with many respiratory illnesses. It's also not uncommon to have that due to either a sprain or a strain of the muscle that occurs, you know, sometimes at night if you sleep wrong, sometimes during an active day. And so it can occur due to a variety of reasons. And those things can take a few weeks to improve. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, but what Gary's experiencing, I think, is very, very common.
Gary, go to the doctors, my friend, and let us know how you get on. Mina is saying, my back has been sore since having children. It's been 6 years. A massage temporarily gets rid of the soreness, but it's back the next day, which I think begs the question, when is it time to go and see a specialist? Is it starting with a doctor, maybe getting a chiro or an orthopedic referral? When do you go to the pharmacy and get some, you know, hot or cold therapy? What can Mina do?
Yeah. Great question from Mina. So, you know, back and neck pain typically self-resolve. The vast majority of back and neck pain cases will self-resolve, meaning they'll get better on their own. And what you need to do in the intermediate time is do things that will improve the pain. So ice packs reduce inflammation. Heat packs can be good for comfort. And certainly back massage is perfectly acceptable. Acupuncture or dry needling. Many physical therapists will provide those as well. Physical therapy itself or physiotherapy and chiropractic care, you know, all perfectly acceptable ways of resolving back and neck pain. In Mina's case, it's been ongoing for 6 years. So when it doesn't self-resolve, when it does continue in a consistent way, and some people have a minor ache that just doesn't bother them, they can still get by in their day without a major issue, perfectly fine. But if it's to a point where it's bothersome, which in this case, it sounds like it might be, then it might be a good idea to go see your doctor. And your doctor at that point will do an examination, look for a weakness, look for what we would call to be paresthesias or neurologic findings. And what that means is either pain or numbness or tingling in specific distributions. And so, you know, when a physician is doing an examination, they note what you tell them in terms of which parts of the body your pain is. And your pain, mind you, could be radiating. So they'll know, is this pain radiating? And if so, from where to where? For example, is it radiating from the low back to the mid back? Is it radiating from the low back to the buttock? Is it from the low back to the buttock to the back of the thigh, back of the calf, and the bottom of the foot? All of those things indicate to a doctor different parts of the spine that could be injured or affected. And after that examination, the physician may decide that you need imaging. That imaging could be x-rays, could be less commonly a CAT scan, or it could be an MRI, or a combination of x-rays and MRI would be the most common thing. And those will indicate to us whether there's a structural pathology that's there, meaning do you have instability of the spine? Do you have compression of the neural elements or the nerves? And so all of those things, you know, depending on what you have, the treatments will be different, obviously. The other thing that could be is, you know, you could have a long-term muscle condition in that area, or you could also have a joint problem in that area. So the pain could be coming from the joints themselves. And there's three main joints at every spinal level. There's the two facet joints, which are two joints in the back. And then there's the intervertebral disc. And that joint that's the associated with the disc could herniate, could be problems associated with it. You could have pain associated with it. That's known as discogenic pain. If the pain's coming from the facet joints, it's known as facetogenic pain. And often after the imaging, depending on what's found, then an injection, often a steroid injection or sometimes a nerve ablation may be in order. And so all of, you know, those things are possibilities.
There you go, Mina. And I think that'll help an awful lot of people out there who, like Mina, have this kind of ongoing backache. I'm going to squeeze in one more question because I'm personally very interested to get the answer. Message just came in with no name on it saying, do epidurals cause back pain later on in life? I sincerely hope not, because I've had two. So what do you think, Dr. Biden?
No, epidurals do not cause pain later on. There's no indication that they cause a negative long-term effect unless it's a very high volume of them, which if you've had two, that won't be an issue. Most people, you know, generally in our protocols, we wouldn't do more than one epidural in a 3 to 4 month period. Okay. So just keep that in mind. You really don't want them, you know, right after each other. You want
to
wait a little
bit
between them because they do involve steroids, of course.
Dr. Biden, thank you so much for your time today. I cannot think of anyone better to be the author of this book, The Mayo Clinic Guide to Treating and Preventing Back and Neck Pain. When it's safe, we'd love to have you in Dubai. When it's safe, we'd love to have you in the studio. But in the meantime, go and enjoy breakfast with your family. Have a great day in clinic. And we'd love to speak to you again. Lots of questions coming in. Just goes to show this is a really common problem. So thank you again for your insights.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Delighted to be talking this afternoon with Michelle Champlin, Chief Podiatrist at Dubai Podiatry Centre. She is on hand to take your questions, your concerns, your queries. So get them in now. Michelle, lovely to see you on Teams and thank you for your time this afternoon. I know you're incredibly busy, so we've stolen you away for an hour. You're with us until 4 o'clock today. And the clinic's busy. What's been coming in?
Everybody's going so sporty. It's absolutely fabulous. So we're seeing unbelievable amounts of sports injuries.
Really? What kind of sports and what kind of injuries?
Today we've had squash. We've had a hiking mishap. I think they were just a bit dehydrated and had a bit of a wobble. Mm-hmm. And all the kids are back in soccer. So yeah, sport.
It's interesting because, as you say, people getting back into, well, outdoors and classes, kids as well, but a lot of people working out at home over the course of the last year. So perhaps not doing it in a controlled environment with someone watching over. Does that mean sometimes poor technique and then more injuries?
Well, I'm one of them. So I'm working out from home as well. And all the neighbours are as well. So everybody's got the garage doors open. And everybody that I can see and that's been coming into the clinic is pretty well equipped. It's just inactivity, perhaps in a very specific sport that they haven't done for a year, mm-hmm. like squash, that's creating a little bit of problems with the ligaments in the foot. They normally just need about 6 to 12 weeks to get back to their full strength again. it's just starting up an activity you've not done for maybe a year.
Isn't that the absolute classic? You know, you think you're going to get back into the gym or back on the five-a-side and you think you're going to be back at the same pace as before. How many dads do I know who are like, yeah, I was a bit handy at football. I'll play five-a-side. Next thing they know, you know, meniscus or, you know, out within a couple of minutes.
It's the parkour for the parents. They're joining in at the end. There's some free parkour for 15 minutes at the end. So I've actually had a lot of parkour in recently.
Michelle, we've already had lots of messages for you. You are live with us from the Dubai Podiatry Centre until 4 o'clock. Before we get to the text line, we've just been talking with Dr. Biden from Mayo Clinic in the States about neck and back pain. And I was curious, can your feet, your ankles sometimes be the cause of pain, the root cause of, you know, discomfort in other parts of the body?
They can. That's why for our professional athletes that fly into Dubai, and not so much this last year, for example, if they're a professional bowler or baseballer, cricketers, or professional tennis player, they'll be in to see us because they're off a little bit with one foot leaning in slightly. It tilts the pelvis, then it tilts the rib cage, then it tilts the shoulders. An Olympic shooter, we won't mess with them too much because it will put their shot, their aim off. So we have to be careful what we're aiming for, literally, with our athletes. But it definitely does put your neck and shoulders out if you have an alignment problem with your feet. Otherwise, if the feet are all good, then it won't be the cause of the neck and shoulder injuries.
Good to know. No name on this one, Michelle, saying, I've been diagnosed with plantar fasciitis in my left foot in the past, and after treatment, it subsided. But now it's been playing up again since I started indoor cycling at the gym. What should I do?
Indoor cycling at the gym causing plantar fasciitis, it's unlikely to be that, because you need to put pressure on your feet for your plantar fascia to engage and pull off of the heel bone. So if you've been inactive for a while and you start to get active, it's more during the day that the plantar fascia can pull on the heel bone. And it's just like grabbing the hair, a clump of hair on your head and pulling at it where the follicles are on the scalp. It becomes really inflamed. And it's the same as the plantar fascia fibers on the heel bone. So we would look at during the day what's happening with the foot, and do we need to tilt the foot a little bit or lift the arch up, which means the plantar fascia can rest a little bit so that maybe 6 weeks later it's back again to normal.
So offering some relief there. And actually Uni sent a message along those lines as well, saying, my soles hurt every morning when I wake up. I've done all the blood tests, vitals are normal, but the pain is really intense. Sometimes can't get out of bed. What should I do? I had this after giving birth, which I believe is quite common actually in new mums as well.
It is when the fibres are all super, super soft so you can actually give birth. It's not exclusive to the pelvic area. It happens in the feet also. So the bones move a little bit farther apart because they're held together by a soft ligament instead of a super strong cotton-like ligament. So it's very painful, especially when you get out of bed in the morning and put your feet down on the ground. That's when the pain is at its most. But after 20, 30 steps, it starts to feel good again. But it's during the day when the plantar fascia is pulling on the bone and the bone swells a little bit, that's what's causing the injury. So we would address during the day so that after a few weeks it starts to feel good when you get up out of bed.
Okay, really hope that helps, Uni. Keep your messages coming in. Lots. Who knew there were... Well, I was going to say, you know how many problems there are. How many bones are there in the feet? How many problems can be caused by the component parts?
Oh, well, here behind us, we have 26 bones in the feet, 19 muscles, 33 joints and 107 ligaments. So there's quite a few things that can go awry.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about your health this afternoon. We are discussing everything below the knee. Michelle Champlin joining us. She's the Chief Podiatrist at Dubai Podiatry Centre here in Dubai. Well, Hamad's been in touch saying, I haven't played squash in over a year and played the other day. My ankle twisted really easily. It hasn't happened before. I don't think I did anything differently. The shoes are the same. What do you think the problem could be? Are my ankles weak now or I've gained some weight? Could that be the problem? Thank you for your time. You just mentioned a squash injury. Hamad there twisting his ankle after not playing in over a year. What do you think?
Yeah, squash. This is so cool, this Microsoft Teams, because I can show you the skeleton as well at the same time. So the ligaments on the outside of the feet, so squash side to side, it's really difficult to injure the inside ligaments on the inside of the ankle. It's more or less on the outside or the front outside of the top of the foot. And yes, yeah, squash, if you've put on a wee bit of weight, which is fine, moving side to side, it's not as easy as it was when you were maybe a few kilos lighter. So the tension that goes through the ligaments to stop you going over your ankle are under a much more extreme force. And also the ligaments soften a little bit due to inactivity, especially side to side sports. So you may have been keeping up with running in a straight line over the last year, but side to side sports, maybe not so much. So the side ligaments on the side of the foot get a little bit soft. But good news is they tighten up and get their strength back with side to side drills in about 6 to 12 weeks.
What advice would you give to Hamad now, recently twisted his ankle, in terms of getting back, getting any swelling down and dealing with pain as well?
Well, simple things like rest, ice, elevation, compression can all help with the foot at home. But definitely do seek the advice either of a podiatrist or a physiotherapist, osteopath. They'll definitely help you also with getting the injury back to perfect as it was before.
There you go, Hamad. Hope that helps. A message here for you, Michelle, coming on 4001, saying, my daughter was a footling breach at birth and has always been pigeon-toed. She's now 6. My husband is keen that she gets support to correct this, but she manages just fine. Will I be doing her a disservice in the future if I don't help her get that gait corrected now? So can you explain for anyone who doesn't know what pigeon-toed looks like? And are there any kind of long-reaching implications if you don't have it correct at an early age?
Well, in-toeing normally does self-correct over some time. But if there are any worries, it can come from the pelvis. So just double-check with the paediatrician to make sure that the pelvis and the hips are in the right position. And then if they say yes, thumbs up, everything's okay, then bring your daughter in to see us. We'll see her walking and see if it's something that will self-correct or if there's an issue also with the foot or the ankle, that if we tilt them back to straight again, that in itself will help. So definitely check with the paediatrician first to make sure the pelvis and hips are okay.
Okay, hope that helps there. Mubarak was in touch earlier about the time limit for correcting feet. How do you begin to gauge that when someone comes in, whether that's, you know, putting orthotics in shoes or, well, you know, doing manipulations as well, working with you or a host of experts? Surely there's no such thing as a normal amount of time for correction.
Yeah, everybody's different. So it depends on your activity levels, your weight. There's a lot in your age as well, and how much we can manipulate the foot. So manipulation of the foot can be done at any age, as long as we are able to manipulate the foot into whatever position you want it to be in. So if your heel is leaning inverted or everted, we need to see if we can actually get it into a neutral position. And then if we can, we'll see how easy it was to do that or how difficult it was. And then we can gauge how long it would take. Is it going to take 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 1 year, 2 years?
Okay, hope that helps. Katie's been in touch saying, I know there are more important things in the world right now, but I was looking on the Facebook group and a friend mentioned she had a bunion. She put a photo up and she was asking what she should do about it. I then looked at my own feet and realised I had the same thing, but mine is worse. And now I don't want to go to the beach or the pool because I don't want anyone to see my ugly foot. I'm 26 and thought I was too young for the bunion. Is there anything to do? It's made me so embarrassed. There is no such thing as a silly question, for one. And things that might seem seemingly silly to others can have a huge impact on just self-confidence, the way you move around the world, and bunions are incredibly common. For 26-year-olds, what kind of thing would you recommend?
So again, this is amazing with the Microsoft team. So I can show you this little skeleton as I talk about it. So there's a bone called the first metatarsal, and it can move out and create a little bony lump on the outside of the foot, and the big toe can go across and start to touch the second toe. But there's about 20 different types of bunion, so we need to figure out which type of bunion you have. If it is the bone displacement, it should be pretty simple to put the bone back into its place again. Might take about 3 months of treatment, but it should be able to go back into its place. If it's a bony growth, so if the bone is straight and it just grew like a big ear of bone onto the side, that's a surgical case. But plenty of people with bunions can do so many amazing things. But I know if it gets you down, maybe better to come in and show us and we can see what we can do.
There you go, Katie. Please do Do not be embarrassed. Michelle is lovely. Your clinic's on Shakeside Road, so dead easy to find as well. Joe's been in touch saying, I've got a weird sensation between the tarsal and the metatarsal of my foretoe. This means nothing to me, so I'm going to expect you to explain this in a minute, Michelle. Said it's a sort of crunchy, disarticulated sensation, but it doesn't hurt. It feels okay if I'm wearing shoes, but I'm walking around at home barefoot. It feels kind of disturbing. Should I be concerned? Can you turn Joe's message into something the rest of us can understand? What is the tarsal, the metatarsal, and what is the foretoe?
So the I think it might be fourth toe. So if we run our finger along our fourth toe back up towards the top of the ankle, if we keep running it up until we get to almost the top of the arch, we're almost on the outside of the foot. That's the tarsal and the mid and the metatarsal joint, which is quite far back on the outside of the foot. So there's ligaments. Great, I can show you on this video. There's ligaments where this bone will drop down, and those ligaments can feel almost like they're subluxed, which isn't a dislocation, but it's almost a dislocation, and it feels like it might need to be popped back up into place. So normally somebody else might be able to lean on your arch with your top of your foot on the ground and pop it back into place.
Oh, it just gave me shivers.
Or you could sit on your feet, you know. So if you were sitting on your feet and the top of your foot was touching the ground and you leant back a little bit like a yoga maneuver, you could pop it back into place as well. Or come in and we'll do it
Joe,
for you.
Go and see an expert. Don't do any of this DIY jiggery pokery. Please. And if you do it, please don't film it. Please don't send it to me.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking feet this afternoon with the best in the business. We've got Michelle Champlin with us, Chief Podiatrist at Dubai Podiatry Centre, on hand to take your questions, your concerns about everything below the knee. And I can tell you, Michelle, you're a very, very popular woman. And I find it always very interesting to see which kind of clinics and doctors resonate with the people of Dubai. And I think with feet, you kind of get used to living with a certain amount of discomfort, or you think it's normal. And you're like, do I go to a doctor? Do I go to see a specialist? Well, no, you message Dubai Eye when Michelle Champlin's on the line and she'll tell you what to do. Anonymous messages, absolutely fine. This one has no name on 4001 saying, I've started running for the first time in my life. I'm 42 and my feet get so hot. They burn and cramp on the outside of one foot only and I have to stop. I know I'm overweight, but I'm just jogging, not running fast, and I want to keep going. Is it my foot or my shoe, or could it be something else? Thank you.
It's both, and it's wonderful to hear that you're out jogging and running and you've got a weight loss journey. That's fabulous. And it's both because there's a muscle that runs along the outside of your foot and it also goes under your foot. And after a few minutes of running, the feet start to expand and heat up and they sweat. And it can lead to a wider foot in a very short amount of time. And it may be that the shoe fits you when you are cool and resting. And after a few minutes of running, your foot, as it expands, actually begins to press on the side of the shoe. But you wouldn't really notice it. It's not like it's going to cut into your foot. And it presses on that muscle and it starts to make the muscle go numb. And when the muscle goes numb, it then starts to burn. And you literally have to take the shoe off and rub the muscle or stop running. So I would test a few different shoes to get an extra wide fitting so that you can keep your jogging going.
Great advice. I never knew that. It makes total sense. And this is why everyone says, you know, if you're going out to buy shoes, you know, choose the time of day you're going to do it, because your feet do get naturally more hot and swollen towards the end of the day. So the fit will be different depending on when you go shopping. A question here, no name on this one, saying, any advice for children's footwear? Does it have to be Birkenstocks or Pabloski? Do sandals provide arch support? We've talked about before, you're a big advocate for being barefoot. My children are pretty feral and if they're not in Birkenstocks, they're barefoot. What do we need to know for children's footwear? What should we be looking for?
So for footwear, we want, if it's going to be a sandal and they're going to be doing a lot of walking in the sandal, we want a three-point strap. So imagine three seat belts that are going to hold you into your car. So you want one across the top of their foot, one across the arch of their foot, and a strap that goes around their ankle. Now that's if they're doing a lot of walking and running around in that little trekkie sandal. So that's what we're looking for. It's not necessary that they need to have an arch support some children do need an arch support and some children don't need an arch support. So it's difficult without saying a flat-footed child might need a little bit of a soft arch support, and the child that's already got an incredible arch doesn't need the arch support. So it depends on the type of foot that the child has. But the shoe shop that you get it from may be able to tell you which sandal is great for the feet for that particular child's foot, but not all shoe shops can do that. And if it's just to go to the pool or the beach, a Crocs is absolutely fine, or a flip-flop's fine just to go to the pool or the beach. They're fine also.
And we know with distance learning, kids haven't been putting their school shoes on as much as they perhaps would have been pre-COVID. Good news in terms of long-term foot health?
It is. Well, mainly the children are sitting for their online learning. So we're trying to ask some of the parents, can the children stand a little bit for their classes? And also it's sometimes helpful to make them distinguish between school time and home time if they put their little socks on and their shoes on. So that's school time. And then as soon as the school lesson's over, the wee socks and shoes come off.
Good to know. All right, there you go. No name on this message saying, my feet are unbelievably dry. They get so hot at night, I've got to get up and put my feet on the cold floor. But it can happen a couple of times in the night. I rub Vaseline in them, put socks, but it doesn't make a difference. They are still like dinosaur feet. There's no bad smell, which I suppose is a good thing, but they would definitely frighten away small children. Dry feet. And what sounds like really hot feet in the night. What comes to mind, Michelle?
Well, the most common answer for that is a fungal infection, but it's a dry fungus, so it actually does make the skin extremely dry, they can be scaly or look crusty. What most people do is add moisturizer and creams and Vaseline to their feet to try and help the skin not be so dry, but that actually just feeds the dry fungal infection. So it's different to a moist fungal infection that you would get if you were wearing your hiking boots for too long or your sports shoes for too long. So it's a dry fungus, and it stops your feet from sweating, which you don't normally notice during the day when you're moving around. But when you go to bed at night, the feet do sweat a little bit and they cool you down under the bedclothes. But the dry fungus doesn't allow that to happen. So the feet get incredibly hot. You have to put them, like they say, on a cold floor or get in the shower and put cold water on. And we would check the foot to make sure that it is a dry fungal infection, and we treat the fungus to give the elasticity and the lipid level, which is like an oil that's in the skin that supports the opening closing of the sweat pore, which helps to cool the feet when you're sleeping.
That's why I love having you on the show.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're now having a quick fire foot round with Michelle Champlin, Chief Podiatrist. She's on hand to answer your questions. Rhea's been in touch saying, I don't know what's happened to my toenail, but it's not connected to the side of the skin. It's my big toenail on the side next to my second toe. So painting us a picture there. Rhea saying thank you. Any insights there?
Yes, there is a couple of reasons that can happen. It could be aggressive cleaning. So if you're having pedicures and they want to clean underneath the toenails, it can be aggressive cleaning because the nail's not attached very well to that side of the toe because it's more meaty. Mm-hmm. Or it could be that when you stand, if your arch is coming down a little bit and your big toe slides to the side, the meat pushes up on that nail bed side. And then when you lift your foot up off the ground, it comes away again. So up and away, and it can begin to separate it. Or it could be a fungal infection. So we would need to see it.
So well worth getting it checked out to narrow down the issue there, Rhea. I hope that helps. No name on this one saying, my feet really hurt. Got a very hard and painful callus that I feel when I put more pressure on the ball of my foot. I don't know what to do. Please help. This sounds like if you're in a huge amount of pain, go and see the doctor. And see Michelle.
Yeah, come see me, because if you are walking awkwardly to avoid that painful area, we don't want you to hurt your ankle or your knee or something else. So we would check out. It could be an overpressure area from a high arch or a collapse of the transverse arch, or it could be a verruca or a corn. So come see us so that we can help sort that out for you.
Now, Nadia's got a 14-year-old son that says he's very slouched, always telling him to sit up straight, stand up straight, but he says he hurts his back. So I took him to our doctor and she said he has extremely flat feet and this is making it worse. I don't see how his flat feet can make him slouched. I don't see how getting him an insole would help him. Any insights? Thank you so much.
So there's lots of different types of insole. And I'm sorry to hear that he's in pain when he does try to correct his posture. If the feet are very flat, they normally lean in, which internally rotates the legs and tilts the pelvis forward. That tilts the rib cage forward and the shoulders hang forward. So if you ask anybody, you know, especially like, you know, a teenager, to try and straighten their posture, they'll bend their upper body, which will put stress in the middle of their back. So we would check to make sure that the foot may help the back. If the foot's leaning in, we'll tilt it back to straight and lift the arch back up again. And that should make a massive difference to the back. And also maybe some physiotherapy and osteopathy for the back to help your son feel better.
That makes so much sense. I was sitting there kind of turning in my legs, tilting my pelvis, tilting. I was like, oh, yeah, I am slouching now. All right, brilliant. Hope that helps, Nadia. A message here on 400 and saying, my feet became wider with pregnancy. Is there a solution to lessen the width? Very common indeed. A lot of people going up a whole shoe size after giving birth. Can it go back by itself? Or if not, what are some of the things you can put in place there?
Most of the time it does go back by itself. So about 3 months later after giving birth, the hormones begin to settle down and that begins to contract the ligaments that hold the bones and the feet together. If it doesn't do it itself, we can always assist. So just a bit like braces for your teeth, we can lift the arch and the transverse arch of your foot just by using some simple transverse arch lifts. Or if it needs more therapy, we'll use an orthotic. And then if it needs more therapy, we can do electromuscle stimulation. And we can even do binding of the forefoot to hold the ligaments. It works a bit like elastic on your braces to fix a cross bite. So there's loads you can do if it doesn't go back into its natural position.
Oh, there you go. And last question of the day. I'm going to sneak this one in. And I don't know if you can help. I don't know if this is your area of expertise. Saying, my husband struggles with restless leg syndrome. Please help. He can't sleep. My dad has this and he has magnesium oil and he has magnesium tablets. And that seems to be the only thing that's helped him. What do you say in your clinic for anyone else that's suffering?
Yeah, so restless legs, we've only ever seen it when the patient normally has high arches as well. And it's just an amazing amount of nerve innervation to the lower limbs. And so involuntary, they're twitching their legs and moving their feet and it can wake them up at nighttime as well. The neurologist can sometimes give some oral medications for that. So that would be one for the neurologist. As you find out, for your father, the magnesium oils and sprays are phenomenal for it as well. And anything warm before bedtime to try and delay the nerve impulses, like a warm bath, can really help get a few hours sleep.
I knew you'd know. Thank you. Michelle Chamberson will be with us this afternoon. She's the chief podiatrist at Dubai Podiatry Centre. And a great source of information on Instagram as well. Michelle, where can people follow you and some of your advice on that platform?
It's a simple one. It's Dubai Podiatry on Instagram.
You're a star. Thank you so, so much. As ever, always a busy clinic. We'd love to have you back, but get back to some patients in real life. And then lovely to see your face on Microsoft Teams as well. Take care. Michelle Champlin with us this afternoon. And apologies we didn't get your message. As I said, so many coming in. We'll have her back on a regular basis, hopefully in a couple of weeks' time.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is our psychology hour. And we're talking divorce. You were happy once upon a time and planned a future. Now you're 55 and getting a divorce. Or maybe you're 60, even your 70s. Well, you're part of a trend known as grey divorce, or silver splitters, or even diamond divorcees. Billionaire benefactors Bill and Melinda Gates, co-founders of one of the world's largest private charitable foundations, filed for divorce yesterday after 27 years of marriage. He's ranked number 4 on the Forbes list of the world's wealthiest individuals with an estimated fortune of $124 billion. Which just goes to show money can't buy love. To talk more about this growing trend and answer your questions, hear your experiences at Dr. Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, as we discuss the decision to divorce, even after decades together. So Dr. Chastity, grey divorce refers to this kind of demographic trend that's seen a massive increase in the split, the separation of older couples who've been married for a really long time. And in terms of stats, 2017 Pew Research Center report says that divorce rate in America has roughly doubled since the 1990s in adults aged over 50. So what do we know about the contributing factors for grey divorce?
Sure. So I want to put some context around some of these facts and figures that we have. So it has definitely increased dramatically, but still, to put a number to, you know, what proportion of married couples over the age of 50 are divorcing, you know, we're looking at 25%, and it has increased exponentially, and that is quite high. But it's, you know, just to give a little context around that, in many ways, there are a number of factors contributing to why couples divorce after decades of marriage. One of the biggest reasons is growing apart. Things aren't working out. I've lost that spark. And because we've had, you know, certainly in countries where, you know, there's a lot of women as part of the workforce, and so there's the stigma or the financial considerations around divorce make it more possible to sort of, you know, do something about we've grown apart. I've lost the spark. We're just different people. Another risk factor is something as simple as past history of marriage. So if you have had a previous divorce earlier in life, you're 2.5 more times likely to divorce later on in life. So that's another big risk factor. And of course, there are issues related to things like addictions, mental health problems. So in many longstanding marriages, some of these challenges may have been sort of distracted away, or, you know, maybe kids were at home, so they weren't, there was sort of a different level of how it was managed and how people addressed it. But now the kids are out of the house, and now, you know, someone, you know, a partner is struggling with things like drugs, alcohol, or even some of our behavioral addictions, you know, related to how you spend money, or things like, you know, pornography. Those are having a really big impact, and they're kind of, I don't want to say they're shielded during the earlier years of marriage, but, you know, again, because that the earlier years tend to be very busy. Very life-building together.
Yeah. And I think that's the case, you know, perhaps more under the microscope. And, you know, especially we think about the last year, spending more time together as a couple, you know, all those things when they've perhaps been out at the office, you know, suddenly they're in your living room. We're also living longer. You know, statistically speaking, people are living about 30 years longer than the average retiree once did. So, you know, this sounds terrible, but, you know, you might get to 60 and go, you know, 50 years ago, I'm going to die soon. Now you get to 60 and go, I could be living quite happily and comfortably until my 80s and 90s. And I'm never with this miserable so-and-so. I want to crack on and find someone that I enjoy having fun with. And we've seen this in jobs as well. People working longer, changing careers late in life because, I was going to say, life is just too short. No, it's not. Life is quite long, and we want to be enjoying it for as long as possible. Can I ask you, Chatu, do we know about who's instigating it? Is there any data around, is it men or women who are asking or pushing for divorce later in life?
Sure. I would have to look more into the data on that question. It's a great question about who's instigating these later in life divorces, because, you know, again, prior, you know, years ago, decades ago, we knew that, and stigma is still there. I don't want to make it seem like it's not, but there were a number of, you know, social cultural factors that prevented people, from, you know, seeking divorce. And now, you know, that's shifted, and yet to unpack the intricacies of, you know, so who's seeking divorce, after a certain age and under what conditions? Because I think it's important to explore, like, under what conditions are these divorces happening? Because like you said, there are a number of, you know, that sort of growing apart, that life expectancy piece, we're living longer and we change. If we're living till 80 and you got married at 30, there's a good chance that you are not going to be the same person and have the same interests and same likes. And so, you know, what is it about, you know, that divorce later on in life? Is it really about we've grown apart, or those conditions of what have we done to stay connected during the marriage? So I think that's important. An important factor too is like distinguishing like these characteristics or qualitative differences beyond things like addictions, beyond things like previous history of divorce, and like, what are some of these qualitative differences that are playing a role in how this unfolds? And are there things that people can do earlier to sort of work through and safeguard.
Ooh,
you know,
prevention. We'll talk about that soon. Now, one podcast that I think is really worth a listen from a very... well, from a Dubai resident, Caroline Stanbury. She has a podcast called Divorced Not Dead. She divorced from Turkish businessman Sam Habib. And this is how she sees marriage now.
I do believe that marriage is an amazing thing. I just don't believe that it's necessarily has to be forever. I think our lives are built from amazing chapters. You know, just because your marriage ends and or you're not married, you haven't got married, or you're not in the place that you necessarily thought you would be at that age, it doesn't matter, because the rule book has been well and truly thrown out, and life is just a bit of a roller coaster. And if you just learn to glide with it, that actually you will get so much more out of it.
Do you agree or disagree? Do you go into your marriage hoping, expecting it to last forever, or do you view it as a chapter? So does Caroline regret being married?
I don't consider my marriage a failure at all. In fact, I think it's one of my biggest successes. I have three beautiful children. It's brought me to Dubai. It's brought me, I've got a great friend in Jem, even if it's up and down at times, which is normal when your emotions are involved. But, you know, if you all come out with the best part, I have a family, I have a boyfriend. I'm in a really, really good position right now.
Nick has messaged in saying, I don't understand why you divorced after 30 years. You've done all the hard yards, which I kind of see that perspective as well, I have to say.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
According to the Pew Foundation, at a time when divorce is becoming less common for younger adults, grey divorce is on the rise. Amongst US adults aged 50 and older, the divorce rate has roughly doubled since the 90s. Factors behind this include longevity. We're living longer. Now 65-year-olds can easily envision the next 20-plus years being active, and they don't want to be loveless or full of frustration or disappointment. Boomers have given up on the concept of that dutiful but unhappy spouse a long time ago. And we heard in the news today, billionaire benefactors Bill and Melinda Gates, co-founders of one of the world's largest private charitable foundations, filed for divorce yesterday after 27 years of marriage. Money cannot buy happiness or indeed love, although I'm sure if he's on any dating apps, he'll be doing very well indeed. Dr. Chastity O'Connell's with us this afternoon, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, to discuss the decision to divorce, especially after decades together. And I want to go to the text line. There's no name on this message, Chastity, saying, getting in touch as a 40-year-old woman who recently learnt my mum is leaving my stepdad, who's been in my life since I was about 5. I'm absolutely devastated and worried about her being alone in her old age, especially with us here and her in South Africa. It sounds selfish, I know, as she seems really happy about this news. What a shock. I mean, that's my first reaction, that age 40, you think your parents are in a happy, established relationship, and suddenly everything's upside down. She's saying there that, you know, she's devastated about the relationship, but also worried, you know, about her mum being elderly and alone. Any advice there on reconciling her feelings about this decision?
Sure. What she's highlighted and shared, and thank you for sharing your story, is on that devastation. So I think sometimes, when we think about divorce and folks divorcing, I think because they have adult children, it doesn't hurt as much. And it hurts deeply for a number of reasons. At the end of the day, they're still your children. And then there's also considerations of, you know, especially, you know, living in the UAE, the majority of us, this is not our country of origin. So we have families back home. So there's a comfort in knowing that there's someone in the house, because you do worry about those things, about like safety around, you know, who's going to help her, or who's going to help dad open water bottles, or who's going to make sure that, you know, someone to look out for your parents. So it is a huge shock and it is devastating. And I think the most important thing is to, you know, sit with and work through what is the grief and shock. So having, you know, someone, the loss of this idea of the marriage, you know, you'll still have, so it's different than a death in the family, but there's lots of questions of around what does this mean moving forward? What are holidays going to look like? You know, how, you know, the circumstances around the divorce, how the divorce itself unfolds, and whether or not it's acrimonious or not. And so I would just say, you know, be really gentle and tender with yourself. Grieve when you need to the extent that, you know, there's the communication and the relationship is one that's open and supportive, you know, can be helpful discussing these feelings with family members. But if it's not, finding a support group for adult children of families divorcing can be really helpful, as well as reaching out to, you know, certainly friends and family or a professional if it feels like it's really overwhelming. But reaching out to that support to process this loss, because it is a loss.
Chasti, you touched on something there about marriages ending acrimoniously, and I'm curious, you know, how the marriage ends, you know, even after the relationship, you know, continues after divorce. Is that different in older couples, would you say, to younger couples? In my mind, and this is a massive assumption, I think of younger couples being more impetuous, going, it's over, you know, and almost there being an anger, whereas perhaps people being a bit more a kind of accommodating and friendly as they get older. Is this a massive assumption? I know data's hard to come by. What would you guess?
I think what you're sharing is in and of itself shows that we don't have a lot of like exposure to this. Mm. So it's not like it's in the movies. So we have movies of family.
It's complicated
divorcing.
Is the only one I can think of. I think about Baldwin and Streep, and I'm like, oh, I just want to live in that house and, you know, be a baker. But that's the kind of, I think about, you know, a divorce with adult children in the picture. That was the only reference I could think of.
Well, and so, you know, to answer your question, though, it can get ugly even if you're over 50. And why? If you think about, you know, depending on why they're divorcing, you could have decades of resentment and hurt and bitterness. And so, you know, by that point, there, and when we have marital discord, there's this dehumanization that can happen where you fail to see your partner who has hurt you time and time and time again as a human being. And so, you know, when the circumstances are such that, you know, okay, we're going to divorce, they're no longer human. And the claws are out. It's ugly. The children, and sometimes when you have younger children, so when we're, you know, working with folks that in clinic that are in the process of separating or contemplating divorce, there's a lot of effort, you know, spent on protecting the children and providing emotional support, not triangulating. Don't weaponize your children because they're little or young. But adult children, I think parents, you know, there's this, they're grown, you know, and so that restraint. So it just depends on the circumstances, but it's a great question.
And also impact on finances, I guess, when you walk, you know, it doesn't leave much time to financially recover. So things could get nasty there as well. So basically my assumption was completely wrong. The old phrase, when you assume you make it, that's where we're going. I'm just very interested.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So many of you getting in touch on the topic of divorce after decades. We have seen the billionaire breakup of Bill Gates, ranked number 4 on the Forbes list of the world's wealthiest individuals, coming in at, fourth, a mere $124 billion fortune. And Melinda Gates, co-founder of one of the world's largest private charitable foundations. They filed for divorce yesterday after 27 years of marriage. And we're discussing grey divorce, a demographic trend that's witnessed a huge increase in split or separation of older couples who've been married for a very long time. Joining us to discuss and take your questions is Dr. Chasity O'Connell. She's a mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And kind of exploring the decision to divorce, especially after decades together, and taking any of your stories and helping you out as well. Message here saying, I'm a 40-year-old woman who walked out of her marriage last year. Not a bad marriage, but we're different people. I was married when I was 20, but in my culture, divorce is very badly looked upon. Full family looked down on me, insulted me, which pressured me to move back into my marriage. I have a 17-year-old child, but now I feel stuck. I couldn't find anything wrong with my marriage. We hadn't even had a fight. So a 40-year-old woman who walked out, but due to family pressures and culture is now back in that relationship, feeling what sounds like very unhappy, frustrated, and in her words, stuck. Dr. Chasti, what advice would you give here?
So sure. So when, you know, there's a lot of social cultural variables, sounds like it's coming up, along with what is hearing, and I would need more information, of course, deep unhappiness with the quality of the relationship. So yes, maybe it's not fighting, maybe it's not
active discord in that sense, but if it is deeply disconnected, that can feel just as alienating and lonely. And so sometimes, you know, there's different ways we can look at, you know, where do I start with unpacking all this? Is it something where I'm just, you know, struggling with something in myself and that's, you know, affecting my perspective on the marriage? Is it something that is quality in the marriage, or is it something that's coming in from the spouse that's affecting the quality of the marriage? And so oftentimes speaking with a professional can help work through, you know, what is going on to gain that clarity in order to explore what are my options realistically, you know, once I can work with these very, very, very painful emotions, because I think that's what ends up coming up that affects clarity. And of course, I don't want to underestimate the role of family and exerting an enormous amount of pressure. And so some of that work therapeutically can look at, okay, how do I navigate the comments? How do I navigate the you know, holiday get-togethers?
Yeah, and have boundaries that you feel comfortable that you are still, exactly, you know, have some power in that, in those relationships. Truly, exactly, wishing you all the very best here, and taking something of a different stance, no name on this one, saying, would really welcome some advice on what to tell adult children. Ironically, it was our silver wedding 2 weeks ago. Our 22-year-old son lives in the UK, so doesn't know we've been having problems, though the last straw was an emotional affair that my wife had. How honest should we be with him, or just give vague, not happy anymore type explanations? Really interesting question, because it's completely different explaining divorce to a 6-year-old as it is to a 22-year-old. I mean, how much do you want to know about your mum, I suppose? What would you advise in this situation?
So it's tough to understand what are the relationships like that you have. So I think especially when you have adult children, they're probably going to be asking, they're going to be shocked, potentially very upset, or, you know, feeling blindsided. And so, so trying to understand, so it sort of call, and they'll probably be asking a lot of questions. And so I think the best thing is to sort of spend that time talking through with each other, how are we going to announce this? You know, if these kinds of questions come up, how are we going to navigate them? So although we have things like couples therapy to help couples find and repair, there's also separate, you know, therapeutic work that's aimed at making it the most, that looks at these family factors and like, how do you handle and make space for the children's, you know, thoughts, questions, emotional reactions to this? So it's important to, you know, work through that. And I would, in that case, if there is a lot of concern and if it's not, it doesn't feel readily clear on what to do, but also if it looks like it's going to be quite a shock for the children, speak with a professional. And it could be someone, you know, from your, you know, maybe if you are subscribing to a particular belief system, talking with someone, or just reaching out, like, we are separating and, you know, how do we tell our children? There's also some great books and resources on how to do that. And basically, one of the biggest takeaways is that being emotionally available for their reaction and being able to validate whatever it is that they are feeling, which is very difficult if it gets heated. So that's why some of that pre-work can
I know,
help.
It's so hard because I think, it's massively hypothetical, if my husband was unfaithful, part of me would be like, I want everyone to know that he did this and rah, 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 rah. But what you're saying there about being on the same page, I think, is really, really important. And that, and after the heat of a divorce or separation or arguments, that's incredibly difficult to try and achieve. But, you know, big picture, perhaps at all times. I think you're going to really like this question from Em. And Em, I'm sorry you're having a difficult time, but I really think Chastity can help here. Emma's been in touch on 4001 saying, I'm 54 and almost at the end of an overly long divorce process, very delayed due to COVID, children at university, and I'm finding the change of role from wife and mother to singleton very hard. I wasn't expecting divorce at all. Gone on lots of lonely walks, having angry conversations with myself. All the feelings of betrayal, loss, sadness, financial worries, envy, but above all, loneliness. Oh, and the family dog died. So just a couple of awful years. The women friends who stuck around have been so supportive, my absolute lifeblood, but I've lost all confidence and don't know where to start with meeting someone new. Where to start? I'm so sorry. I mean, God, the dog dying is just the absolute cherry on the cake. And I'm so, so sorry about that, which is an absolute very real grief. And the change of identity, as you've said, you know, going from wife and mother to singleton and a pandemic. And, you know, my goodness, what a life adjustment that's been for so many people. But divorcing during that time must be incredibly difficult. She's asking about getting confidence back and knowing where to start when it comes to meeting someone new. Bill Gates is available. That's good, isn't it? Every cloud. what would you say to Em about feeling ready to date again?
Sure. Well, I would, in what I'm hearing, because it sounded so painful and unexpected and not knowing about some of the circumstances around it, it's important to really highlight that divorce can be devastating and almost a trauma-like for many people. And so that affecting sleep, affecting eating, affecting being able to focus and concentrate. And certainly, you know, she had mentioned shattering this confidence and feeling, you know, good about oneself. So, you know, a worldview has shifted. And so with working through that, there's a number of different things that you can think about looking at, you know, how, you know, certainly books and resources on how to slowly allow yourself the pace to feel all of this and how to learn to talk to yourself compassionately and kindly, how to speak to that inner critic. But also, you know, emotion processing is really important because I think what happens sometimes is that we try and push them away. And then, you know, after a while, we find that we're just angry and irritable and really, really triggered. And so I would just say to the, you know, sort of taking that inventory of where am I? Do I feel like I'm coming out of the other side of this grieving process? And, you know, I can do this, you know, growth-oriented work and trying to figure out who am I, the identity piece, or do I find that I'm still very, very triggered by thoughts and feelings? Because that signals maybe looking at some work with, you know, a professional on how to process these emotions. Like, is this, you know, residual kind of trauma related, you know, trauma quality feelings that are going on? Or is this, okay, we can start looking at, you know, how to rebuild, how to grow and move forward. So I hope that's helpful. It's really complicated. So I want to, you know, speak to, there's a number of factors that influence it. And I can only imagine that pain. And sometimes also connecting with divorce support groups can be immensely helpful in dipping your toe back in that socializing water. And the fact that you have social relationships that are supportive is amazing. So you've got a lot of great things going for you. So it's just asking
absolutely,
yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, an end of a relationship can be devastating and heartbreaking, but sometimes it's the end of a negative relationship, and that's just you know, coming back to what Caroline Stanbury was at the beginning, you know, it's the end of a chapter, and the end of a bad relationship is a positive thing, you know. So it's I would say starfish for a while, enjoy having the bed all to yourself, and as Chastity's saying, you know, reach out and spend some time on you. Figure out, do you actually want to be in a relationship right now? Do the things you've always been wanting to do. You know, you're only 54. My goodness, this could be a really exciting time. So thank you, Chastity. Really appreciate it. Sonia's been in touch saying, Helen, don't forget to tell the gentleman that Melinda's also available too. She's not worth as much as Bill, but I think she's going to be all right. Dr. Chastity O'Connell, really appreciate your insights as ever. And you can find Chastity and her colleagues at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.